rage erupts around the globe as the world is rattled by images of carnage and suffering in both Israel and Gaza. The U.S. tries to step into the void to tamp down the chances of a growing regional conflict. And how a Supreme Court case about commercial fishing could have a huge impact on how the U.S. government functions. And a verified vision of the Virgin Mary in the U.S. We take you to the farmland of Wisconsin, to the shrine of Our Lady of Champion.
We saw its devastating impact, with children being torn to pieces.
I was deeply saddened and outraged by the explosion at the hospital in Gaza yesterday. And based on what I've seen, it appears as though it was done by the other team, not you.
Tensions are high as protests erupt across both the Arab world and in countries friendly to the U.S. after the explosion at a hospital in Gaza. The repercussions of the conflict between Israel and Hamas have expanded well beyond their borders as passionate reactions flood in from across the globe. The President of the United States made a quick trip to Israel to provide strong and visible support while cautioning against what he called an all-consuming rage that could lead to the deaths of innocent Palestinians. And demonstrations erupted worldwide, mostly in Arab countries and Europe, as protesters' emotions hardened against Israel and the U.S. All this as the fate of the hostages held by Hamas and the growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza hangs in the balance.
Ya Allah! Ya Allah! Ya Allah! Ya Allah!
Video of an explosion that has rocked the world. A missile hitting a parking lot beside a hospital in Gaza City, where Palestinian refugees displaced from their homes were sheltering. In the aftermath, a doctor at the hospital spoke to reporters.
We have the right to live in peace, and for every Palestinian child and woman to have a safe haven. This hospital was that safe haven. But tragically, civilians and children were targeted.
Hamas claimed 500 were killed, blaming Israel. The Israeli military quickly denied it was responsible, providing evidence it was an errant rocket fired by Palestinian militants, the Palestinian Islamist Jihad. No telltale crater indicative of an airstrike. The hospital remains standing and intact.
According to our intelligence, Hamas checked the reports, understood it was an Islamic Jihad rocket that had misfired, and decided to launch a global media campaign to hide what really happened. They went as far as inflating the numbers of casualties. They understood with absolute certainty that it was a rocket misfired by Islamic Jihad that damaged the hospital.
Blaming Israel and the United States, much of the Arab world erupted in protest across the Middle East and Northern Africa. Enraged demonstrators gathering outside U.S. embassies or Israeli consulates in multiple countries, launching fireworks, throwing rocks, only to be repelled with water cannons or tear gas. Into a situation that appears to be spiraling towards chaos, America's president landed in Israel on Wednesday, embracing Israel's prime minister in a show of solidarity for an ally devastated by the Hamas terrorist attack 2 weekends ago, in which at least 1,400 people were massacred and as many as 200 taken hostage.
To those who are living in limbo, waiting desperately to learn the fate of a loved one, especially to families of the hostages, you're not alone. We're working with partners throughout the region, pursuing every avenue to bring home those who are being held captive by Hamas.
President Joe Biden's task was difficult.
as he simultaneously expressed support for Israel, encouraged the flow of humanitarian aid to innocent Palestinians trapped in Gaza, worked to broker a release of the hostages, and sought to tamp down rage that could lead to a wider regional conflict.
You can't look at what has happened here to your mothers, your fathers, your grandparents, sons, daughters, children, even babies, and not scream out for justice. Justice must be done. But I caution this: while you feel that rage, don't be consumed by it. After 9/11, we were enraged in the United States. While we sought justice and got justice, we also made mistakes.
In making the trip, Mr. Biden was originally supposed to travel on from Israel to Jordan to speak to three key Arab leaders from the immediate area: King Abdullah of Jordan, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. But with demonstrations against Israel and the U.S. raging in their streets, the meeting was canceled. But the diplomacy continued in Air Force One on the way back to the U.S. After negotiations by phone, the president announced Egypt had agreed to open the Gaza border crossing to allow trucks with humanitarian aid supplies to cross.
My point to everyone is, look, if you have an opportunity to alleviate the pain, you should do it, period. And if you don't, you're going to lose credibility worldwide. And I think everyone understands that.
Thursday night, the president took his message to the American public in a rare Oval Office address to the nation. He explained why the U.S. needs to support Israel, and he likened that to what he sees as the need to protect democracy in Ukraine as well.
We're facing an inflection point in history. One of those moments where the decisions we make today are going to determine the future for decades to come. Hamas and Putin represent different threats, but they share this in common. They both want to completely annihilate a neighboring democracy, completely annihilate it. Their adversaries and competitors are watching. They're watching our response in Ukraine as well. And if we walk away and let Putin erase Ukraine's independence, would-be aggressors around the world would be emboldened to try the same. The risk of conflict and chaos could spread in other parts of the world, in the Indo-Pacific, in the Middle East, especially in the Middle East. American leadership is what holds the world together. American alliances are what keep us, America, safe. American values are what make us a partner that other nations want to work with. To put all that at risk, if we walk away from Ukraine, if we turn our backs on Israel, it's just not worth it.
The president announced he was sending an urgent funding request to Congress on Friday, requesting $106 billion to support democracy in Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, and humanitarian aid and border management. He called the request an investment that will pay dividends for American national security for generations. As he has done several times since the beginning of the conflict, Pope Francis spoke out again this week against what he called the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza.
Inquieta il possibile allargamento del conflitto.
The possible expansion of the conflict is worrying. While in the world, many war fronts are already open. Silence the weapons. Listen to the cry for peace of the poor, of the people, of children.
During his weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis announced a day of fasting and prayer on October 27th for all those who care about the cause of peace in the world. It will be capped with an evening prayer service in the square. To help us analyze what happened this week, the growing regional unrest, and the possible way forward, we're joined again by Alberto Fernandez. He's the vice president of the Middle East Media Research Institute and a former high-ranking diplomat and ambassador with the U.S. State Department. Alberto, thank you for joining us again. Let's discuss this controversy over the hospital in Gaza. Both the Israeli government and President Biden, and now the U.K., citing supporting an independent intelligence from the U.S. Defense Department. They're being countered by the Hamas claims that an Israeli missile was to blame for the explosion at the hospital. Despite that evidence, there is still division over the facts. Huge demonstrations have erupted, faulting Israel and the U.S. for the deaths of innocents. But this Hamas propaganda machine seems to be winning. With Muslims and Christians alike, how can we get the truth out?
Well, in war, we always talk about the fog of war. So we'll never 100% know the reality of what happened until later. But certainly we have enough footage to show that the initial claims that were made about the hospital being destroyed were completely false. The hospital is still there. What does seem to have happened is some kind of explosion in the parking lot outside of it, and innocent people were killed. How many is another question, because the numbers have ranged from, in various media and intelligence accounts, from close to 1,000 to 10. So there's a lot of manipulating the facts and, propaganda going on.
The media is very worried. They're all claiming that it's so hard to get facts from the ground. How is it that we can differentiate, as people who are not experts, between Hamas, Hezbollah, the Palestinian Jihad, all of these different organizations, and the Palestinian innocents?
Well, I mean, they're different organizations, certainly as far as the United States government is concerned. Hamas, Hezbollah, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad are terrorist groups. They are legally considered terrorist groups in the United States. You can go to prison for supporting them. Obviously, the overwhelming majority of people in the Gaza Strip or West Bank or whatever are, innocent people unaffiliated with terrorist groups, and they're at the mercy of the conflict. They're caught between whatever these terrorist groups do and the Israeli response.
It's interesting to think about the reality of Palestinians on the ground. And President Biden was walking this tricky line to support them, as well as supporting American allies, while de-escalating the situation on many fronts. What can we make, then, of this cancellation of the meeting with Jordan, with King Abdullah, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi?
Well, it's just, the situation was incendiary at the time. It was right after the initial false reports about the bombing of the hospital, and to be meeting with the American president for these three Middle Eastern leaders is just not politically expedient. And so Abbas canceled, and then the other two decided it was not a good time to do it.
And then they all got on the phone.
Except for Abbas, who refused to take the president's phone call.
So then, in this fraught time, with emotions they're riding so high in both Israel and the Arab world, chances for lasting peace start to seem really remote. But during his visit to Israel on Wednesday, President Biden kept coming back to this idea of a two-state solution. Let's take a listen to what he said.
Nations of conscience, like the United States and Israel, are not measured solely by the example or power. We're measured by the power of our example. That's why, as hard as it is, must keep pursuing peace, must keep pursuing a path so that Israel and the Palestinian people can both live safely, in security, in dignity, and in peace. For me, that means a two-state solution.
Many have compared the current two-state solution policy discussion to talking about peace with ISIS on September 12th, after the Twin Towers were destroyed. Is this really where the hearts and minds of the people in Israel and Palestine are? Are they broken?
I mean, it's the worst I've seen in quite a while. But, there's a little bit of bait and switch going on here. You know who doesn't believe in a two-state solution? Hamas does not believe in a two-state solution. Hamas attacked across the borders of 1948 Israel, the borders of Israel internationally recognized by over 100 nations. So we have a problem. Of course, two states living in peace side by side is a wonderful dream. It sounds logical, makes a lot of sense in many ways. But the reality is that this conflict, this specific conflict, was started by a group that believes in one state, one Islamic state ruled according to Islamic law as part of a broader Islamic empire.
To join the surrounding Islamic states around in the area. So quickly, as we all join the Holy Father in our prayers for peace, what is the situation for the hostages? Friday morning, Israel said that they believe most of the hostages are still alive, but they're not sharing the details of how they know that.
Well, we certainly hope that they are still alive. Of course, it's going to be an incredibly difficult situation because, without a doubt, they're going to have been separated into small groups. Some people may be in worse shape than others, people who have, the elderly and people with medical conditions that were kidnapped. Incredible to think that, elderly people and people with medical conditions were kidnapped, but they were. And so it's a good thing that they're alive, but they're probably underground. They're probably separated from each other. So it's a very difficult situation.
And there are still Americans in both Gaza and Israel, and the U.S. estimates Hamas might be holding as many as 13 of them in the estimated 200 hostages, not to mention those who remain because they either live there or were visiting. And we know Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has now sent two planes to retrieve American citizens. How are these flights able to happen?
Well, I think it's just really smart creativity by the part of the Florida governor. I mean, the federal government often tends to move very bureaucratically and slowly and has certain constraints. And I think he saw an opportunity to help people, and he arranged this, and he got some people out of danger's way. So that's great that he did that.
Now, Alberto, we're all worried about the threat of escalation elsewhere. It's significant. Where should our viewers be watching? Lebanon and Hezbollah, or the potential for Iranian nuclear developments?
Well, in the immediate, Lebanon is key. You know, Hezbollah's entry into the war would be qualitatively change the situation and would be probably be the trigger for a regional war that would include Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, meaning Iranian-controlled militias in those countries, and could expand even further, bringing in Iran. So I would watch most closely the situation in Lebanon.
Well, we'll be watching that and relying on your analysis. Thank you so much, Alberto.
Thank you.
When we come back, we head to the Vatican for details of this week's happenings at the Synod on Synodality. Plus...
So Loper-Bright is a case that's largely being used as a Trojan horse for some broader attempts to change the role of expertise and science in the way that our government operates.
The pros and cons of government power. A look at an important case before the U.S. Supreme Court about commercial fishing, a decision that could impact the power and influence of federal agencies. Both sides of the argument ahead.
You've heard of Our Lady visiting Guadalupe in Mexico or Fatima in Portugal, but did you know she also visited Wisconsin? That story coming up.
And later, we take you to a shrine dedicated to Our Lady of Champion, the only verified Marian apparition in the United States. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
The conversations continue at the Vatican as bishops, men and women, religious and laity wrap up the third week of discussions and prayer at the Synod on Synodality. The historic General Assembly has hosted interventions on many hot-button issues, including the blessing of same-sex unions and the ordination of women. Archbishop Anthony Fisher from Sydney, Australia, a Synod participant, spoke exclusively to EWTN's Colin Flynn, saying he thinks too much time is being spent on these issues, when really the focus should be on bringing people back to the faith.
The big issue for the church today, particularly in the cultures I know, the Western world, where we've got the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S, the ones that say they have no faith. When there's a census, they write no religion. Well, just tick the no religion box. And that's going up and up and up, particularly amongst young people. You're looking at, in many populations now, half the young people are saying that they have no religion.
This week, participants are wrapping up discussions and working on the Synod's final report for this session. Hannah Brockhaus, senior Vatican correspondent for our sister news organization, the Catholic News Agency, and Dr. Matthew Bunsen, editorial director of EWTN News, have been following the Synod closely from our Vatican Bureau. Thank you both for joining us. We're on week three of this Synod. And this week, the main focus was on authority, decentralization, and the co-responsibility of the laity. Hannah, what was said to set up this discussion? What was everything about?
Well, for one, Cardinal Jean-Claude Pollerick gave an introductory speech to this topic to all the Synod delegates. And something he touched on was the fact that the media, the big media, is focusing on just a few issues, whereas they're called to look at the bigger picture and not these specific changes. So he, as well as Father Timothy Radcliffe, a Dominican priest, and then Father Dario Vitali, a priest, an Italian theologian, all three of them set up this issue. Vitali spent a lot of time focusing on hierarchy and the church's theology around that and how we need new institutions, new structures according to synodality.
Well, that's interesting and something we'll touch on in a second because it makes some people nervous. Matthew, we did see some participants leave the synod early this week, two bishops from mainland China. Is this unprecedented, people leaving before everyone else wraps up?
No, it's not unprecedented. In fact, in 2018, during the Synod on Youth, the two bishops who were allowed to attend from China actually left at almost the exact same time that the two this year decided to leave. It was given as an explanation that they had to depart for, quote, pastoral reasons. But the similarity between this and 2018 is striking in the sense that it prevents both of those bishops to their participation in the final discussions in this final coming week. There is still representation from the People's Republic of China, however, as we have Cardinal Chow from Hong Kong, and there is also a bishop from Taiwan.
So they're not left without anyone representing their people. Hannah, let's talk about these hot button issues of the synod, which includes the role of women in the church. What can you tell us about how those discussions are going and the interventions of the women delegates?
Well, it does seem to be that there is a bit of tension, that there is some disagreement among synod delegates about this issue. So especially the issue of ordination of women, whether that's ordination to the diaconate or ordination to the priesthood. So we heard from one delegate who said that, you know, as a woman, as a theologian, and as a mother, someone who works inside the church, she doesn't worry about not being ordained. Whereas, you know, we've heard that there have been other interventions where people have called for other speeches where people have perhaps called for the church to reassess that situation, to look again at the ministry of diaconate for women.
And what do those discussions entail in terms of what might come out of the synod? Have you heard anything about where people are going? We know the Holy Father has stressed many times that he has no plans to ordain women.
That's right. Right now, the only answers you can really get from officials are just that we're all listening, we're discussing. There's no predetermined outcome here, that everyone is just gathered together to discuss these issues. And just today, a bishop said that we're here to listen and see where the Spirit takes us.
Well, we'll be praying for the Holy Spirit as well. This is a little frustrating. Matthew, many of the faithful, going back to what Hannah said, are worried about the impact of the synod from a structural perspective. Cardinal Czerny and Bishop Flores. Bishop Flores, who's particularly important as the man in charge for the USCCB, preparing everyone who came to the synod from the USCCB, they both addressed this in the synod press conference, saying it poses no danger to the future of the church. Synodality poses no danger. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I was at the press conference, and both were asked specifically about the question of a conspiracy theory, or that the Catholics, frankly, are just very concerned. And as we were hearing from Hannah, the vagueness of some of the structures, as well as the open-ended nature of the discussions. We've had proposals put forward for the ordination of women, for example, and then we had the discussion in this week about church structures, especially in light of synodality. All of that has been found disturbing to a lot of people. It's one of the reasons why I think Cardinal Czerny, and in particular Bishop Flores, went to some pains to try to stress that no, this is no danger to the structures of the church. As Bishop Flores said, all he has seen in these discussions are faithful Catholics, as he put it, sub tutela Petri, under the education or the guidance of the Holy Father. And I think that reassurance is something we're going to continue to see over the next days.
Well, that's something we're going to be watching and something that Cardinal Mueller has commented on a lot. So we'll be watching for his comments. Hannah, you profiled the day in the life of a synod delegate, a U.S. synod delegate. How has that changed and how has this structure evolved over the last couple of weeks for them?
Well, of course, more or less every day is very, very full for them. They follow more or less the same schedule when it comes to prayer, meeting in the morning, breaking for lunch, and then meeting again until around 7:15 in the evening. But this coming week, actually, there will be some more days off as they kind of wrap up discussions and prepare this synthesis document that will be presented at the very end.
Well, we'll be watching very carefully for that document and looking for your analysis. Thank you both so much. EWTN News will be providing special live coverage of the Synod on Synodality all next week, every day at 5 p.m. Eastern. Be sure to tune in for exclusive interviews with church leaders, Synod participants, and analysis from our expert panelists.
What Pope Francis says, which I think is so important, is to look into the eyes of a suffering person and to touch the wound of a suffering person.
Missionaries the world over. As we head into World Mission Sunday, a talk with the National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies in the U.S. about its critical work around the globe.
Mission work, the very essence, harkens back to the lives of the apostles, going to far places, proclaiming the faith to those who do not know Jesus. Our church renews our commitment to missionary work every year on the second to last Sunday of October with World Mission Sunday. The World Mission Sunday collection is overseen by the National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies of the USA, Monsignor Kieran Harrington. EWTN's Colin Flynn met with him when he traveled to Ukraine's war-torn towns during the Easter season of 2022. Harrington brought supplies and aid to Ukrainians and prayed with them. Monsignor Harrington spoke with Colum this week to talk about the important work of the Pontifical Mission Societies and the impact Sunday's collection has throughout the world.
Monsignor Kieran Harrington, great to meet you.
Great to be with you.
Now, this Sunday, World Mission Sunday, often when we think of the missions, I know that coming from Ireland or the States or Irish American, you think of the missionaries who went out across into the depths of Africa. You often think of it as a thing from the past, but the missions are very much alive and happening today.
Absolutely. You know, there are 1,100 missionary dioceses throughout the world, mostly in Africa and Asia. But when you think about the missions, you want to think about a church which is poor.
Yes.
Which is persecuted, which is young. So it can be poor and young. It can be persecuted and young. Key question is it a young church? Is it a church which is now just coming to maturation? And, you know, Colm, the Irish have so much to be grateful for and have so much to give the church. In fact, I can think to myself that my vocation in part comes from the Irish Holy Ghost Fathers who were in Biafra in Nigeria, because after they were expelled from the country, they came to the United States and in New York, and often my family was very associated with them. So
And they came back with their stories.
They came back
and
with their
testimony.
And they would come to our home, celebrate Mass, hear confession, and then take up a collection for the missions.
Wow.
That's what we do on World Mission Sunday. We pray for the church. We pray for the church in the mission territories, and then we take up alms to assist the church in the mission. Our work, the work of the Pontifical Mission Society, is purely evangelical. Now, what you know, of course, is from the gospel is, of course, if you're preaching the gospel to someone and they're hungry, you have to attend to their human need, their hunger. So there is a humanitarian aspect to our work, but our work is primarily evangelical. And so our work is to build up the church in the developing world so that they have a greater capacity. Their diocese has the capacity to form people in the knowledge of the faith, understanding of the faith.
As you say, how can someone be evangelized when their stomach is grumbling because they're hungry or they need someone to care for the kids or their kids not getting an education? You can understand how that's their priority at that moment.
It's a real part of it. And it's a sign value. Our charity is a sign of our great love for them.
Yes.
Right? But we don't want to create a dependency. So this is the tension in the mission churches is that we don't just bring money and give money and that's it. There has to be a sense of ownership from the local community. I just came back from Hosanna and Ethiopia and visited a very, very poor parish, Church of St. Joseph. And in this church, there were over 1,000 children in school. They didn't even have desks. They don't have pens. The children are in filthy, dirty clothes. And many of these children are orphaned. Their parents were dead as a result of war. Why is the church there? The church is there to show them their human dignity So even without having the basics to teach, they're still instilling a sense of dignity in these children. And it's in these children, their parents see this, then of course they come to know Christ. And in that parish alone, over 6,000 people are going to Mass. And it's our responsibility, first and foremost, on Mission Sunday column, to pray for the missions. That's why, you know, the thing that every priest should be doing is speaking about the missions on Mission Sunday and the importance of the missions. And then, of course, if I'm speaking about the missions and I love the missions, then I'm going to want to take up a collection for the missions.
When you look at, again, the suffering in Africa, and you travel all across the continent, these countries like Ethiopia, so minerally rich, such abundant resources, but yet the people in such large areas in such poverty, and the church has to come in and help.
Well, you see a real wealth gap.
Yeah.
The rich and the poor, and this is related to corruption. Colin, this was only 2 days ago, so I'm telling you from 2 days ago, I was at this baby home, an orphanage.
I saw on the photographs online.
And the sister starts to cry at the very end as we're leaving. She says, "Father, I need milk. I don't have baby formula for these children." And this nun was in a panic because she has these children whom she cannot feed. But here's the problem is she's playing with me for milk. And then I get in the car and we're driving. And the bishop is saying to me, at our seminary where we have, you know, 45 students, we have no water. Father, we need money for a well for our seminarians because they have no way to drink water. The complexity of how many problems do you face and what problem do you solve and what problem do you solve first? And this is really the reason why what's most important for the Catholics back home, the most important thing is to pray for the missions. And this is a challenge for America. Why is America so rich? Why is it that everything that we export is so valuable? The whole world wants iPhones and McDonald's and Burger King and Coca-Cola. But the thing that we don't give is the most valuable thing. The thing which lasts forever, which is the gift of faith. And this speaks to our own poverty. This speaks to the poverty of America, because so many Christians are not living their faith as missionaries.
Monsignor Kieran Harrington, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Missionaries continue to reach out to the poor and marginalized, providing education, pastoral care, medical aid, evangelization, and humanitarian aid globally. The annual financial appeal happening this Sunday in every parish around the world helps more than 1,100 mission dioceses. Go to onefamilyinmission.org to learn more about World Mission Sunday. World Mission Sunday is also a spiritual appeal for Catholics to pray for those missions, as well as to recommit themselves to our common vocation through baptism, to be missionaries by praying and taking part in the Eucharist and giving. We're back in a moment with the Week in Review. Continued paralysis on Capitol Hill tops the Week in Review, as Congress is still without a Speaker of the House. The inability of the Republican majority to agree upon a leader of the House of Representatives means our government is unable to pass any legislation, including wartime aid to Israel or Ukraine. After three votes this week on the House floor, Republican nominee Jim Jordan of Ohio was unable to get the required amount of support needed to be named Speaker. A backup plan also failed when enough support could not be mustered to strengthen the powers of the Speaker pro tempore, Patrick McHenry of North Carolina, so at least the basic business of the House could be conducted. Not only does the $100 billion in war aid requested by President Biden for Israel and Ukraine remain in limbo, but also a mid-November deadline is looming to fund the federal government. A political upheaval in Poland with implications across Europe. In an election last weekend that drew the highest turnout since the fall of communism, voters ousted the ruling Law and Justice Party in favor of a coalition of opposition parties. Opposition leader Donald Tusk, a former Polish prime minister and European Council president, will now form a new government, which is expected to draw closer to the European Union. The populist Law and Justice Party has governed Poland since 2015 with staunch Catholic support. During that time, Poland instituted a near-total ban on abortion and moved to strip courts of their independence. We're following a major case at the U.S. Supreme Court that could change the power of federal agencies. In this instance, the impact an agency can have on private businesses. It's a case that might also have a long-term effect on religious liberty.
The case?
Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. A group of New Jersey herring fishermen are challenging a National Marine Fisheries Service regulation requiring fishing companies to pay for inspector observers on their boats. These observers are part of a monitoring system created by an agency under the Department of Commerce to make sure there's no overfishing. The costs for these companies, big or small, can exceed $700 a day.
There's going to be plenty of trips that monitor will make more than myself or my crew.
You know that a lot of thought went into what level of observing they were going to ask for the fishermen to cover in order to try to limit that cost down to the minimum amount.
The Loper Bright case could wind up overturning what's known as the Chevron deference doctrine. This interpretation of the relationship between the power courts have and that of federal agencies emerged from a 1984 case called Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, where the court ruled that federal agencies can interpret laws that are ambiguous, relying on the knowledge of their own subject matter experts. Chevron enables federal agencies to fill in any gaps in legislation that may be vague. The doctrine ultimately shifted power from the courts and Congress to agencies like the Food and Drug Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, and others. The argument now is that federal agencies often have too much power and lack public accountability and transparency.
The concerns that I have about paying for the monitoring is that long term, is it financially feasible? Because I'm on such small margins now.
But those in support of Chevron doctrine say allowing experts at federal agencies to establish regulations about important matters that legislation does not address is a matter of safety. And those regulations are created within a detailed public process and aren't finalized until there are formal notices and opportunities for critiques and comments.
What happens to all the other parts of the government that we rely on to keep us safe from toxins exposures and to keep our workplaces safe? They'll be relying on individual judges to use their judgment about what keeps us safe, what would overfishing be.
Attorney Paul Clement, the former U.S. Solicitor General, is arguing the Loper Bright case for the plaintiffs at the High Court. He joins us now to further discuss the implications a decision in this case might have. Paul, it's great to have you back. It's been a while. The structure of the American government is built on this system of checks and balances. And those supporting the fisheries in the Loper Bright case, you will argue, they say that federal agencies are abusing their power. But do we want non-experts making decisions on what drugs are legalized or what new rules will come out of an agency?
Well, Monty, it's great to be with you. And I think you have to be careful about sort of accepting the idea that the people making these decisions in the agencies are so-called experts. I mean, I don't think it really takes any great scientific or technical expertise to say that, well, you know, we don't have enough money here at this agency, so we're going to make the fishermen pay for the monitoring services. I mean, that's a classic decision that really has nothing to do with science or technology and has everything to do with political accountability. And our framers thought about these issues. They wanted the taxing and appropriations power all to be in the Congress. They want to have an agency that can make so many regulations that it couldn't actually afford to enforce all of them without making the regulated parties pay for additional federal monitors.
Now, Paul, you're talking about money in terms of fees, but cases like this have come up in the past where you're talking about fines for not complying with regulations, like the case of the Little Sisters of the Poor or the case of the transgender mandate. Are these also the exact same situation of regulations that are made by agencies that don't have subject matter expertise?
I think so. And even if they have some claim to subject matter expertise, they certainly don't have political accountability, and they don't necessarily have the kind of expertise that takes the balance and interests of other people into account. So Little Sisters case, which obviously I'm familiar with, is a perfect example, because there all Congress passed was a woman's health mandate. Well, that's easy for Congress to pass. Who's against women's health? but they left it to the agencies to decide how to fill out the details of the mandate. And those agencies are the ones that decided that all 20 forms of FDA-approved contraception have to be covered in every employee plan, including the, in every employer plan, including the little sisters. Now, that's a decision where you might think that HHS and FDA have some expertise about the drugs or the contraception, but what they have no expertise in is how to make accommodations for religious exercise. And I have a lot of confidence myself that if instead of allowing Congress to just get away with this vague women's health mandate, that Congress itself had to get to the level of saying, all right, contraceptions are going to be provided as part of these plans. I think the law might not have passed in the first instance because it would have been so controversial. But if it did pass, I'm pretty sure that Congress would have worked out a compromise that would have accommodated the religious interests of the Little Sisters and other groups like that. So I think there are real costs to allowing the politically accountable Congress to kick some of these issues to agencies that are not politically accountable.
So in this case, we're talking about fishermen. Are they unique, or are small businesses affected by these government agencies in other ways or exclusively affected by agency regulations?
So I don't think the fishermen are unique. I think they're a perfect encapsulation of how the administrative state in Washington can end up regulating not just, you talk about the Chevron doctrine, you think about big multinational corporations. But in reality, a lot of the people who are subject to very costly federal regulations are small business people in a variety of different industries where things that I think the framers would have thought are left best to local government are being regulated by the federal government and not by Congress, but by these agencies. And the small business people in particular really don't have the resources to try to go to these agencies, get the ear of people in these agencies, participate in the so-called notice and comment process. That's easy enough if you're a big multinational corporation, but if you're a herring fisherman or other small business, that's not really a process that's open to you.
Now, there are many who say that this will ruin the government's ability to keep Americans safe. What do you tell them?
Well, I say, really, do you really think that our Congress people don't care about safety? I mean, of course they care about safety. And there are areas where the federal government should be regulating, where Congress should make clear what the rules are about safety. And there are other areas where I think the framers was designed to have state and local governments responsible for safety. You know, some of these issues are best dealt with at a nationwide level, but a lot of these issues are best dealt with at the state and local level. And the advantage that essentially everything other than an administrative agency at the federal level has is it's just easier for people to make people accountable for their decisions.
Do you think, Paul, then, that Congress, as divided as it is right now, would be able to do some of what you've outlined? Is giving them more power and more forcing them to do more work, basically, a good idea?
I actually think it is. I mean, I know that may sound counterintuitive to some people, but think about the dynamic we have right now, which is Congress is, you know, it goes back and forth whether the Republicans or the Democrats are in control, but it's always closely divided. And at any one point in time, roughly half the people in Congress have their friends of the same party running the administrative, the executive branch and all those administrative agencies. So why would they ever make a compromise when they can get their friends in the executive branch to get them exactly what they want? And what that does is it leads right to the kind of paralysis we see. There's no incentive to come to a compromise that's going to be enduring across one administration versus the other. Instead, there are all these incentives to basically say, I'm going to just kick this can down the road. I'm going to leave things vague. Because at least right now, my friends in the executive branch can fill it out. And then the law will change every 4 years. That's not what the framers had in mind.
Not to be at the whim of political power. Where, Paul, we will be watching this closely and look forward to argument before the court. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Take care.
She really appeared here. The church has approved it. And now people are coming to experiences.
A Catholic shrine in the U.S. gets new attention.
as a stop on the Eucharistic Revival pilgrimage and as a site of a little-known Marian apparition, Our Lady of Champion, next. Earlier this month, EWTN News attended an inaugural Mass in Wisconsin, celebrating a new solemnity of Our Lady of Champion and the renaming of the shrine there in honor of the only church-approved Marian apparition in the United States. Even many faithful who live nearby are not familiar with the little-known apparition. But the shrine will be a stop on the pilgrimage for the Eucharistic Revival processions next year. And reporter Mark Irons says those who oversee the shrine are eager for national visitors.
Throughout history, some estimates show there have been more than 2,000 reported claims of Mary, the Mother of God, appearing around the world. The vast majority of claims are unconfirmed by the Catholic Church. Following critical investigations, less than 30 apparitions have been officially approved.
The Queen of Heaven touched down here, right in front of you.
And in the U.S., there is only one church-approved Marian apparition. It took place in a tiny community many haven't heard of, Champion, Wisconsin.
A place of welcome, solace, and refuge.
Surrounded by farmland, about a 15-mile drive outside of Green Bay, a simple brick chapel is built over a shrine, marking the place where a poor, uneducated Belgium immigrant named Adele Bryce was visited three times in 1859 by the Virgin Mary.
The Queen of Heaven appeared here, which is really astounding.
Bishop David Ricken of Green Bay says Mary's message to Bryce in the American apparition was unique, in part because it focused on educating children in the faith. Mary said, "Gather the children in this wild country and teach them what they should know for salvation.
Teach them to make the sign of the cross. Teach them about Jesus. Prepare them for the sacraments." And so it's children-focused. And that's a beautiful mission. And when you hear that kind of language, we're talking about catechesis, huh? Religious education. That's what Adele did.
For the rest of her life, Bryce carried out her mission, walking on foot for miles to spread the faith to children. As a lay woman, she never made religious vows, but insisted on wearing a habit. Others joined her in her mission, and a schoolhouse was built near the spot of the apparition so the children could gather. In her last appearance, the Virgin Mary parted with these words, "Go and fear nothing, I will help you." And so visitors to the apparition site have prayerfully asked for the help Mary promised, calling on her by the title Our Lady of Good Help. But while American Catholics may be familiar with church-approved apparitions in other parts of the world and Mary's titles associated with those places, like Our Lady of Guadalupe, Our Lady of Fatima, and Our Lady of Lourdes, over all these years, many Catholics in the U.S., even in Wisconsin, have been unaware of what took place in Champion.
Sometimes people have never heard of this, even people in our own area.
That's why October 9th, 2023, marked a historic day in the history of this national shrine. On the 164th anniversary of the apparitions, a solemnity mass was celebrated, honoring the Blessed Mother for the first time as Our Lady of Champion, associating her with the very place she appeared.
Well, it truly is historic, I think, in the sense that we can honor her under a new title and sort of make her mission known better.
A new title for Mary, putting Champion, Wisconsin on the map.
The best kept secret in the world was over here for a long time.
Going forward, the new name could spark greater interest. For Pat Bershinger, a volunteer at the Our Lady of Champion National Shrine, family history is rooted deep in this holy ground.
I'm going to be 80 years old, and I start coming when I was about 3. So you do the math.
Bershinger is blind, but her memories are vivid. Her parents and grandparents would pray the rosary here on Sundays, and when she was a very young girl, her great-grandfather told her about a miracle. In 1871, 12 years after Mary appeared to Adele Bryce, the deadliest fire in U.S. history still to this day broke out in Wisconsin. The Peshtigo Fire is estimated to have killed between 1,500 to 2,000 people or more while burning 1 million acres of land. As the fire raged around Champion, Bryce and others in the nearby communities, including Bershinger's great-grandfather, a 7-year-old boy at the time, gathered around the chapel and prayed to the Virgin Mary.
They came here to the shrine to pray. They even took some animals along, according to what my great-grandfather told me.
The fire was engulfing the region, but it stopped right before the grounds here at Our Lady of Champion.
Prayers were answered and rain began to fall.
The fire stopped right at the fence and they were saved.
The day after the fire was the anniversary of Mary's apparition. Miraculous stories of her intercession continue to come out of Champion. There's one incredible account from James Gillis, who now has increased devotion to Mary.
Because of what she did for me.
In 2021, Gillis believed he needed an urgent colonoscopy. On multiple occasions, he had discharged large amounts of blood, but he was having trouble scheduling a medical procedure. All the while, he continued to pray.
I came here to the shrine asking Our Lady that she'd intercede and I would be healed from this because it was, you know, I was getting concerned.
After leaving the shrine, his condition worsened. He rushed to the emergency room. He was losing more blood. Nurses tried to keep him conscious.
I started to go unconscious, and they were trying to keep me awake and all this stuff. But then when I was unconscious, then our Blessed Mother was right there. I had this deep impulse to totally surrender myself into her hands because I knew that I was going, that I wouldn't be around. It was the most incredible, beautiful experience.
Gillis firmly believes he was on the brink of death with Mary leading him into heaven. But as he began to pray for the loved ones he'd be leaving behind, he thought of his wife, and he wasn't ready to leave just yet.
And that's when I pleaded with her to live. And, yeah. And she heard my prayer.
He gained consciousness and later learned the doctor wasn't sure he'd survive. But a follow-up procedure found no issues, and a healthy James Gillis now enjoys the grounds of Our Lady of Champion with his wife. And so do families who might come for special masses or evening prayer walks.
So I think as Catholic parents, we have a duty to pass on our faith.
The Blessed Mother's message to Adele Bryce to teach the faith to children still rings out.
If we're to ensure the next generation of Catholics, then we need to do that. Daily prayers, weekly mass, all those things that are so important.
A path to holiness will continue to be forged here in a unique way, especially as the shrine will be a stop on one of the pilgrimage routes next summer, leading to the National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis, an event years in the making open to all Catholics to renew love for Christ fully present in the Eucharist.
The closer you get to Mary, the closer you're going to get to Jesus, and especially his presence in the Eucharist.
So whether this is your first time hearing of Our Lady of Champion or not, know a warm Wisconsin welcome has been officially extended.
Oh, come visit, come. We'd love to have you. The peace here, everybody tells me they receive a gift of peace.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
And that's our program for this week. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again next week for EWTN News in Depth when we will share more news and reports important to your Catholic life. See you then.